You are listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. Today I'm speaking to our head of education, Dr. Steve Davies, about the long view of Brexit. While everyone is understandably debating the impact of Brexit over the next 2 years, Steve addresses the economic and geopolitical consequences of the decision over the next 10 years, arguing that Brexit, in itself, is likely to have a much less substantial effect on growth than many would believe. These outcomes, he argues, are far more likely to be determined by UK domestic policy. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out more podcasts on our iTunes channel. Steve, quite understandably, most people are speaking about the short-term to medium-term impacts of Brexit. But it seems that for most people, their long-term view of Brexit is very emotive, whether they like it or whether they don't. Should we be focusing more on the impact of Brexit in the long term?
I think we should think about Brexit in general in a long-term historical perspective, rather than focusing obsessively, as we are doing at the moment, on the ins and outs of the negotiating strategy of the government and the short-term economic impact on, for example, the city or elsewhere. Obviously, these are important matters, but I think there's too much of a focus on the short-term and not enough trying to think about the longer-term history of Britain as a country, a political community, its relations with Europe, the nature of the political community that we are. And these kind of political issues are what really lie at the heart of the debate we've been having for quite a few years now about our position in the European Union. In the short term, there may be quite considerable economic impacts from Brexit. But in the medium term, most of the economic research shows that the effects are not that great in either an upward or a downward direction. So studies indicate, for example, that if we leave the EU and everything goes really well, then we'll have probably a 1% to 1.5% boost to GDP. If we leave and everything goes as badly as possible, then we'd have about a 2 to 2.5% hit to GDP. And those are, you know, they're not inconsiderable numbers, but on the other hand, they're not that big. And also, what I think is generally clear is that it's very unlikely that Brexit by itself is going to significantly affect the long-term trend growth rate of the British economy. It's not, contrary to the more excited leavers, going to make us suddenly become a super dynamic economy. And on the other hand, it's not, contrary to the more pessimistic and gloomy Remainers, going to lead to us suddenly becoming a stagnant economic backwater. What will determine those kind of outcomes is the decisions made by British governments in the aftermath of our leaving the European Union, rather than the mere fact of leaving the European Union itself. So the whole kind of focus upon what the economics of Brexit will be and what its immediate short-term effects are likely to be is, I think, rather misguided. We need to think in a much larger scale and a much longer term.
When we're thinking about those longer terms, do we have to ask ourselves, is Britain now going to be an insular community focused on its nation, or should it still be a part of the EU in a wider context?
Well, that's precisely the kind of question that we need to think about. And in fact, actually, I think the whole history of Britain's relations with the European Economic Community, as it was originally and latterly the EU, is driven by competing ideas about what Britain's place in the world actually is. Now, British politicians, for various reasons, have presented our membership of the EEC, latterly the EU, overwhelmingly in economic terms. It's being presented as being essentially an economic bargain, which was intended to revive the British economy in the 1970s and to bring us subsequently various economic benefits of one kind or another. But actually, the real issue, which has divided politicians ever since the 1950s, is over, firstly, the place that you think Britain has in the world and its connections with the rest of the world. First of all, should we as a country be oriented primarily towards our nearest and closest neighbours on the European continent? Are these the countries and people with whom we should have the closest economic, personal, political and social connections? Or should Britain, for historical reasons, see itself as being connected not just to Europe, but generally to the whole world outside, because of our historical links with North America, South Asia, East Asia, Australasia, large parts of Africa as a result of the British Empire and our long history as a trading and seagoing nation? Of course, there's also a third view, which you sort of allude to there, which is that actually we should be neither of those things, but rather a kind of little England, a small inward-looking community. Personally, I don't think many people actually adhere to that view. There obviously are some people who adhere to that view, but I think the two competing views amongst both the public at large and the political class are between the two options I've mentioned. Britain as part of a kind of European community of nations, or Britain having connections of equal importance with many, many other parts of the world, as well as Europe. So that's one of the big issues. I think the other big issue is the question of what kind of political community Britain is or should be. Now, a lot of people have argued that essentially Britain should be and remain a sovereign, self-governing political community. An independent state, or sovereign state in the kind of classic sense of that word. And this is associated typically with affection for the traditional institutions of the British Constitution, parliamentary sovereignty and all the rest of it. On the other hand, there's the equally well-argued view that Britain should actually see its future as being part of a larger political community made up of European states with a kind of pooled sovereignty and increasing common governance. And this tends to be associated with the idea that really we need to radically reform or transform the British Constitution, that we essentially have a monarchical constitution that's now out of date and no longer doing the job that you want a political constitution to do. This is the view that Anthony Barnett, for example, has been arguing in his various books and columns. So those are the two big issues. Where do you think Britain sits in the world, and how does it relate to both Europe and other parts of the world? And secondly, what kind of political community should Britain be? Should it be a part of a larger European project, or should it continue to be a self-governing and sovereign state of its own?
From a historical perspective and also a practical perspective, is it even an option for Britain not to be a part of a wider EU community?
It's certainly a practical option for it to not be part of an EU community. The fact that we're geographically close to Europe doesn't logically or necessarily imply that therefore we have to be part of a European political project. In terms of the economics, for simple reasons of proximity, we're always going to have lots of trade with Europe. That's a straightforward function of what's known as economic gravity in trade theory. The thing is, though, that we already export a majority of our exports outside the EU. Our exports to the EU are declining as a share of total exports. Our exports to the rest of the world are growing. On the other hand, we import very large amounts from the EU. We run a very significant trade deficit, in fact, mainly with Germany. So it's not a matter of cutting ourselves off from that. It's a matter of whether or not it makes sense, given our geographical location and political history, to be part of a particular wider European community, or whether we should retain significant freedom of action. Now, I don't think you can argue or should argue that there's anything inevitable about either of those positions. I think it's lazy, quite frankly, to say that, oh, just because we happen to be 22 miles across from France, therefore we have necessarily to be an integral part of a particular political community based on that part of the Eurasian landmass. That's actually a political choice that you have to make, and I think what you need to do is to actually make the case for that choice rather than just relying upon, like I say, lazy arguments about inevitability.
Is there a bit of a timeline issue here as well? Perhaps one of the reasons that we're focused so much on the economics when it comes to Brexit and not anything else is because the United States has taken over that role in terms of foreign policy of being the superpower of the world. And so where we look at where Britain is incredibly influential, the economics matter so much more than perhaps other things might have, you know, 40, 50 years ago.
Well, it's certainly the case that Britain is no longer in any sense a major military power. And in fact, I think the British political class have even now a kind of exaggerated notion of how significant we are as a military power. On the other hand, I don't think it follows that because the United States is now the world's predominant military power, at least for the moment, that therefore Britain can't really have any kind of independent role. There are many, many countries in the world which have a very active and independent role, and it's also worth making the basic point that an independent role in the world and an influential role in the world does not depend upon and should not depend upon the possession of significant military or physical power. There's always the great role of soft power, as it's called, the kind of cultural influences that certain parts of the world have on other parts of the world. And here, I think Britain's position is extremely strong. In terms of soft power, we are actually one of the most influential countries on the planet. Through the English language, through the influence of our historic literature on world culture, through the influence that British thinkers and intellectuals have had on thought around the world, and also through the very great influence of our popular culture and our creative industries on the popular culture of the rest of the planet. The model here would be Japan, which is a country which, thanks to its constitution, does not have great military power or the capacity to project its power anymore, but which does have what people often don't realise, a surprisingly high degree of cultural soft power. An amazing amount of contemporary popular culture comes from Japan, in fact, and I think that that's the kind of model we should be thinking of following.
Is there any short-term decision when it comes to Brexit that could be made right now, whether that be, say, the decision on the free movement of people, whether that be whether or not we're going to fully pull out of the European Court of Justice? Is there any one particular thing that could happen in the short term that would truly impact on Brexit in the long term?
I actually think that's probably not the case. If we go for the option of remaining in the European Economic Area, then you could argue that we're still basically tied into the European project, which is one of the reasons why, of course, many people, you know, support it. However, even there, though, I think that that wouldn't settle the issue. I think that if we were to join the EEA on a Norway kind of basis, I think that very soon there would be strong pressure either to reverse the original decision to leave and go back to full membership, or else to move on from the EEA membership into something more completely detached. So actually, I think that despite the obvious and natural focus on the short-term decisions that we need to make about what our relationship with the EU is, what kind of relationship we have with the European Court of Justice and other things like that, despite our focus on that, I think that actually it's more the fundamental political decisions that we make at the moment that are going to have big long-term effects rather than these short-term ones. In the same way that it was our decision to actually join the EEC in the 1970s that had the big effects rather than the concrete decisions that we took about issues like fishing or farming or things of that sort at the time.
So who or what is going to determine the vision of our long-term Brexit?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I think, as I said earlier, one of the problems is that our political class has for over 40, 50 years now avoided confronting the fact that the issue here is a profoundly political one and raises issues about the nature of the state and its relationship to the rest of the world. Instead, they've preferred to focus upon narrowly economic, pragmatic issues. And I think the time for that has passed now. Our politicians have to step up to the plate and actually engage in a debate about these matters. Now, the interesting and in some ways difficult feature of this, though, is that the divisions I've just described don't correlate in any neat or straightforward way with either party allegiance or support for, on the one hand, a market economy, or on the other hand, a more socialist or collectivist economy. There are people with both kinds of views on both sides of these arguments. So, for example, many, many people in the Labour Party historically opposed to Britain's membership of the European Economic Community or the EU. Jeremy Corbyn has a long history of voting against all the European treaties. But it's not just the left wing of the Labour Party, people like Jeremy Corbyn or earlier on Tony Benn, who take this view. Hugh Gaitskell, who was the great leader of the Social Democratic right wing of the Labour Party, was also a strong opponent of Britain's membership of the EEC in the early 1960s. Similarly, in the Conservative Party, there are many, many people on both sides. And I think that actually, hopefully, what will happen the next 2 years is that in addition to having lots of rather nitpicky debates about the minutiae of negotiations, we will also have more serious debates which will cut across party lines, I think, about what sort of place we think Britain should have in the world and what kind of political community it should be. And this may well lead to some very interesting alliances being formed and some very interesting disagreements.
I hope you're right, though I'm not too optimistic. If we go back to the 2017 snap election, each main party's positions, the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, on Brexit weren't all that different from each other. And yet, every day in the media, if a Conservative says something, Labour must oppose it and vice versa. It doesn't seem that they're anywhere close to coming towards crossing parties and actually speaking about those philosophical and long-term issues.
Well, that's the nature of electoral party politics. It also reflects the fact, I think, that the leadership of the Labour Party in particular knew that they had a very difficult balancing act to carry off, which they carried off brilliantly, I have to say, between appealing on the one hand to working class Leave voters in the north of England, on the other hand angry middle class Remain voters in the southeast of England and London. So they had to be very, very careful about what they said to avoid revealing their hand too clearly in terms of the policy views they took about the Brexit process, because if they came out clearly on one side or the other, they'd alienate one of those two blocks of voters. The Conservative Party, for their part, also divided, and so consequently they also were in a position where they couldn't really or realistically have a proper argument about this. I think, however, that given that we have a parliament without a clear majority right now, what is going to happen in the next 2 years is that we will see debates in parliament over the big questions, if you will, questions like should we join the EEA, should we have a free trade deal, if so on what terms, and that these debates will indeed cut across party lines. We will see alliances between, for example, the wing of the Labour Party that includes people like Chukwuemeka on the one side and certain people on the Conservative Party like Anna Soubry, for example, versus, on the other hand, people who are in favour of a more clear or decisive break with the EU in the Brexit process. And I think these arguments are perhaps going to bring out the more philosophical issues that we need to really talk about.
Are you, Steve, optimistic about the long term for Brexit?
I am, actually, in the sense that I think in the short term there will almost certainly be a lot of uncertainty, which is never good for the economy, and there may be some short-term hits to certain places. I think the City of London, for example, is probably going to take quite a big hit. I'm quite pessimistic about the options for us keeping the passporting rights for the City of London, for example. But I think that in the medium to longer term, it will actually revitalise political debate in this country, because so much political debate essentially has not taken place, because a lot of the issues that we might be talking about are simply off the table because some of the positions that people would want to adopt were not available because of our membership of the EU. So nobody's been able to argue for either radical free trade, free market policies, or on the other hand, a kind of more state-directed and radical socialist policy, because it was well known that the kind of policy proposals that either of those two sides would come up with would be simply ruled out of court by the EU treaties and EU law. And so I think that what will happen in the medium and longer term is that we'll actually have a much wider ranging and I think ultimately much more fruitful political conversation.
For more podcasts, blogs, videos and reports, visit our website iea.org.uk and subscribe to our YouTube channel, username IEA London.